Hello and welcome to Civility and Solutions, a podcast brought to you by your Court Services section of the Supreme Court of Ohio. I am your host, longtime justice enthusiast, Kate Munger. This is a podcast about inspirational ideas for courts from across our 88 beautiful Ohio counties. Today's topic relates to mediation technique and especially caucus. We are going to talk about why a mediator might choose to have a separate session with the parties. And we'll also find out how an advocate for a party can help their client get the most out of the mediator's presence in a caucus to promote the client's objectives. The views expressed by guests to this podcast don't necessarily express the views of the Supreme Court. We are happy to be able to use this platform to share solutions and challenges with courts and any listeners who want to stay on the cutting edge of dispute resolution and court services issues. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 10. Our topic is Why Caucus? Capitalizing on its strengths, minimizing its drawbacks. Joining me today is a mediator who won a Lifetime Achievement Award and then just kept on achieving, Professor Emeritus Josh Stolberg. Thank you so much for being here today.
Pleasure to be here, Kate. Thanks so much.
The award I referenced was a Lifetime Achievement Award from the American College of Civil Trial Mediators that you received in 2013, but I really don't think you're someone who's resting on your laurels. Can you tell our listeners about what you're doing now?
I continue to teach some targeted courses in mediation negotiation at both Moritz and a couple other law schools on a visiting basis. I am emeritus from Moritz, and so my days are not spent preparing only for classes, but I love to teach, and I do that. I'm heavily involved in a project called the Divided Community Projects, which is based at the Moritz Law School, that focuses on the use of the mediation processes and other collaborative problem-solving processes to address the social justice challenges of our time, ranging from police practices to pandemic dimensions in terms of equal or unequal distributions of burdens and benefits, immigration issues, and things like that. So I work with wonderful people.
Yeah, I've heard of that Divided Community Project. There's a lot of great people involved in that.
Yes, one of the best skills I have is aligning myself with really talented people who are doing great.
Me too. That's why I do this podcast. So I get to meet all these amazing people. You are very well qualified to teach dispute resolution because you literally wrote the book on mediation, a law school textbook called Mediation Theory and Practice. And I would like to ask you about some of your practical mediation experience. You've mediated around the globe on matters of incredible significance. What mediation experience do you look back on as, wow, I can't believe I got to be involved in that?
Well, actually, two kinds of experiences. I, quite by accident, fell into doing this work when I was living in Rochester, New York, and had the opportunity. I became involved with a group of local citizens who were developing what has become the Rochester Center for Dispute Settlement almost 50 years ago. And part of the kinds of cases that were stimulating the development of centers like that at that time were some of the things that we're confronting today. There were civil rights controversies, the women's movement, anti-war demonstrations. But as I became the director there, one of the anchor programs of the center was a program annexed to the court to handle what were referred to at that time as, quote, minor disputes. They were actually typically criminal claims filed against one's neighbor for harassment, you know, theft of property. And those kinds of cases presented challenges to traditional adjudicatory processes, mostly because developing effective solutions were challenging in terms of legal remedies. So I had a chance to help develop and implement the program so that, you know, neighbors who, you know, had a tree whose bushes were hanging over their neighbor's yard and apples were falling or things got, or people throwing rocks in one another's swimming pool in the backyards, or playing actually things called record players and sound systems like that in apartment buildings, and the sounds would travel through and upset the neighbors. I got involved in doing a lot of those cases and training people to do it. And frankly, those kinds of interactions are in no way minor to the lives whose people's lives are affected by it. And from a mediating vantage point, it has remarkable rewards in terms of if one's helpful, successful in helping people resolve something like noise complaints or the behavior of dogs, barking dogs. One just felt one made an enormous contribution. One learned a lot about the mediation process. And so when I utterly by luck and chance had opportunities to participate in, as a mediator in controversies that, you know, were matters, frankly, that garnered national attention and media attention, the occupation of some public lands by a group of First Nation peoples, so the governor of the state got involved, the White House got involved. You know, those have been remarkable opportunities for me to try to be of service, and working with a lot of very talented people and people who were interested in exploring a peaceable resolution. I've been very lucky in doing a limited number of those kinds of cases.
That's so interesting to where you start and where you can go with mediation, really, all over the world. Yeah, and right. Yeah. Any level of dispute, it's all the same process, right? I mean, really.
There's a sense in which that's true.
I'm sure it gets more complicated.
The fundamental values always remain the same, always remain the same.
And let's talk about one of those fundamentals. We're going to delve into the topic of caucus today. And let's start with the very basics, because we might have some non-mediators in the listening audience. Since our focus today is the technique of caucus in particular, can you explain what that term means? It kind of sounds like something you might do to waterproof your shower.
That's close to caucus. That's great. I love that. Caucusing, but it is a jargon term. It simply means meeting separately with the respective parties or stakeholders to the controversy to conduct presumptively confidential private conversations for purposes of exploring people's perspectives, concerns, aspirations, and ideas they have for what would be acceptable for moving forward. So if the general picture of a traditional court process is everybody's in the courtroom, the witnesses are called to a witness stand, they testify, they are subject to cross-examination, and it's all as an important value of fundamental due process to be able to hear the case against you and to present your case to a trier of fact, be it a jury or the judge. The notion of a separate meeting with a party to the controversy, if a judge were to call for a recess and say, I want to meet with the defendant and his counsel out of the hearing of plaintiff's counsel or in a criminal case, the prosecutor, our reaction would be that it's inappropriate for a judge to do that as a violation of the right to hear the case against you, due process concerns. In the mediation process, separate meetings are viewed as a legitimate procedure for the mediator to use in an attempt to advance the goals of mediation, which is to increase communications, engage in problem solving, and explore various kinds of options for resolution.
Yeah, and this topic was
answer to the question.
No, it's a good answer. And this topic was something you selected to present on at the Ohio Supreme Court 2020 Dispute Resolution Symposium that was unfortunately called off due to the pandemic. What drew you to select caucus as a topic for the conference?
Oh, thank you for that question. It's a great question. The practice of mediation as it has evolved over the last 20 to 25 years, with particular growth, robustness, and dominance of its use in resolving court annexed claims. So the state of Ohio court systems for a long time have been encouraged to use mediation. Other states throughout the country have systematically supported, indeed almost mandated, its use prior to trial. So cases involving breach of contract, construction disputes, civil rights claims, employment disputes, personal injury cases, many of those cases now go to the mediation process. And a number of people, you know, very skilled, talented persons are performing that role and being hired by parties and the courts to conduct the mediation process. One of the features that parties have experienced is a difference by practitioner mediators in how frequently they use the caucus, if they use it at all. And it's been some, and so it's been somewhat controversial. There are some very successful mediators whose viewpoint is that resolving a dispute using mediation is a process that is best executed by having the parties present all the time, and their counsel, all the time. They know the facts and concerns better than others. They know their interests and their priorities. And the result is those practitioners never caucus. They view it, there's a well-known model of mediation out of a place called the Harvard Law School, called the understanding-based mediation model. They will never caucus. Quite typically, a number of people who do family mediation cases believe that the parties, the future soon-to-be ex-husband and wives, if that's a scenario, they need to figure out how to work problems out, particularly if there are children involved. So there are a number of family mediators whose practice is always keep the people in the same room. At the other end of the spectrum, there are now a number of successful mediators, not only who use it, but will never put the parties in the room together in what's referred to as a joint session. They will do the entire mediation, conduct the entire mediation process by caucus alone. And that has drawn both support and some fierce criticism that it's contrary to the goals of the mediation process. So I thought it valuable for us to have at the Ohio conference a session on this. My own perspective is that the dominant format should be as in a courtroom. Parties meet together in joint session and share some information and try as hard as they can all together to work out matters in a fashion acceptable to them. But I do believe there are times and plausible reasons why it might be helpful in promoting those goals of increased understanding, problem solving, exploring resolutions, that the best technique for doing that is to meet separately with the parties. So I endorse its use if it's done in a thoughtful, purposeful way.
Okay, so is that what you consider to be the primary goals of mediation, would be that understanding, problem solving?
Exactly. You know, I think, you know, and I think that reflects sort of the conventional perspective and understanding of the mediation process. But a procedure, you know, it's mediation is a directed conversation, a facilitated conversation, where what you hope will happen is people will share information so people have a better idea of what their differences are and possible shared interests or a consistent interest, that the mediator, if she's doing her job, will prompt each of the parties to engage in suggesting and exploring and analyzing ideas for what would be acceptable as a way of a resolution. And I think part of the goal of the mediation is the goal, you know, having people share ideas with the notion that you try to find concrete terms of agreement that people can embrace so that in an important way, and it's easier to understand it in the legal context, the quote case is resolved because each party has agreed to perform certain things for one another. And in that sense, the case is closed.
And of course, empowering them to make their own decisions instead of leaving it up to the guy in the robe at the front of the room who's new to the case, new to the parties, new to the industry sometimes.
That's exactly right. If the process has human dignity, it will be one in which particularly the parties, the clients, and their legal counsel, conducted in such a way so that nobody's coerced into making decisions. They have the opportunity, to engage in what jargon terms are, quotes, self-determination or empowerment, and that it's conducted with a degree of dignity. It doesn't mean it's quiet and they're not shouting matches in the room, but it's done with a fundamental respect for how to treat the person on the, on the other side of the table, but however many parties there are, that each person gets treated with dignity and respect.
And from the mediator's perspective, how does the caucus help the mediation and keep that dignity and respect going?
I think of that as there being two or three primary values in terms of it helping the mediator to use the caucus. And they build, I know this is sort of armchair psychology, but I think it's accurate, at least in terms of my experience. I think it's true that many of us, for certain kinds of situations, we're comfortable sharing information about the person with whom we're in a dispute if the other person isn't sitting across the table from me and I have to say it. So I might be willing to tell you things about my supervisor, the dean of the law school, but not if she's sitting across the table. I might not say everything I want to say or that might be helpful to understand the situation if, in point of fact, the person with whom I have the dispute is sitting across the table. And so meeting separately gives the participant, from the mediator's perspective, it sets a comfort zone in which persons may be willing to share information with you, the mediator, that you would find helpful in understanding the situation better or thinking about possibilities. But you're not going to get it if that adversary, advocate, opposition party is in the room. The second thing about the value to a mediator of a separate session is, I think, builds on the phenomenon of if you and I are the parties to a dispute and I'm suing you for $100,000 for personal injuries, or you fired me from a job and I think my damages are $100,000. And you say to me across the table, Stahlberg, your claim is worthless, but to settle this case, we'll offer you $27,000 to settle it. Yes or no? It's very hard for me, if you're sitting across the table, to respond in the following way. Well, 27, let me think about that for a minute. And then try to think it through. If I say that, you are going to say, oh, you agreed to 27. Let's do it. And you turn to the mediator and say, we've got a deal. But being alone allows me to actually be able to say, well, 27, let me see, maybe that could work. But it's not in front of you. So I'm not making an immediate commitment. So there's room to sort of play around with ideas in a way that doesn't not coerce me, but to prompt, I can be more free to play around with possibilities without having to make commitments. And so I think that's the second, important reason why a mediator, wants people to play around with ideas. And a caucus serves that purpose. The final reason a mediator would want to call for a caucus is sometimes, and it often happens a little later in the session. Sometimes, to use the expression of a police officer friend of mine from years ago, the mediator needs to drill one party's just being
That's unrealistic.
Difficult.
Difficult.
Or obstinate nice, in a yeah. way that just doesn't seem plausible. Mm-hmm. And in the language of my friend is, the mediator in an appropriate neutral way needs to drill a set of brains into the people in terms of what's possible in this conversation, what's doable. And if he or she continues to, you know, maintain that position, it doesn't, you know, the mediator might say, might express some skepticism that the mediation conference is going to end in an acceptable way to everybody and might have to bring it to a close. So there's sometimes where a mediator, in doing her job of being a reality tester, of exploring options, might have to say something that the party will hear as an attack on her and favoring the other side. In point of fact, the mediator's language needs to be careful so that she's not making those mistakes, mm-hmm. but the party's going to hear it that way. Right. And if it's done in a separate session, there are ways that a mediator can sort of handle that
more delicately. And okay, so looking at from the other side of the table, what benefits do you see from the advocate's perspective? If I'm an attorney with a client in mediation, why should I be interested in caucusing with the mediator?
Well, to some extent, they track the mediator's reasons, but there are a couple separate ones. I mean, the first is meeting separately with the mediator enables the advocate and his or her client to explore options without having to make an immediate commitment. And so you can do it in front of the other side. It won't invite the other sides to say, see, you don't have a very good case. You need to say, so you can explore possibilities without having exposing yourself as an advocate or a party. The second thing is, and it happens quite frequently, at least in my experience, is that the parties and their advocates can signal to a mediator, and they often do this, where they're flexible. And they can say, look, Josh, if the number weren't $100,000, but it were in the $50,000 to $65,000 range, that might be something we'd be able to think about. Well, they're never going to say that if the other person's in the room. But if they trust you, and after a while, you know, I've heard people literally, I was quoting, you know, locutions people would make. It's in the party's interest and their representative to communicate to the mediator, if they have, presuming they have confidence in the mediator, where there's room for a possible accommodation. Now, whether it's going to be a number or sort of generally, you know, I want to assure you, Josh, we're here to explore resolution. They can say those kinds of things in a caucus more comfortably. Another reason an advocate might want to call for a caucus is that sometimes it's the case that a party is actually prepared to accept a framework for resolution, but they don't want to be the ones who communicate it. They want it to become, quote, the mediator's idea for a suggested proposal. Well, they can't do that if the other side's in the room. So in the caucus, they can say things like, look, if we want you to know, we'd be prepared to resolve this matter in the following way, but we're not going to tell the other side. But I want to assure you, Josh, if you came back to us with your proposal that looked like this, we'd accept it.
Right.
And so that can be done. And the final thing I think is important in a caucus is the parties have the responsibility and their counsel. You know, they're investing time in the mediation. They want to make it work if it makes sense to make it work. But they can say often in a caucus to the mediator, here's where we're really firm and there's no room for movement here. And if it can't meet these parameters, there's going to be no resolution. Now, the first time they say that, they're testing the mediator. And so the mediator is going to push back a little bit. But at some point, there's going to be enough trust between the advocates and their mediator so that they can say, Josh, we mean this. No more on this. You know, they're not going to get the job back. It won't work. And that's valuable information for the mediator to know in terms of, does it make sense to continue the mediation? Are there other possibilities for resolution? Or is it time to call the session to a halt?
Okay. And let's talk about some problems in a mediation that caucus might help fix. If you're stuck as a mediator because you have a really difficult party, like they're just not agreeing to anything in a joint session, are there some things that caucus can help solve, some problems that can be solved? And what are some ways that caucus is used to problem solve more than other ways?
There are lots of goals or purposes served by a caucus. I mean, if people are quite literally screaming at one another across the table, there's a certain sense in which that kind of exchange is important for everybody to hear, including the mediator, and one needs to be comfortable with it. But if it's becoming a problem and just the conversation's disintegrating, one can call for a caucus just to minimize the unproductive conversations. You can take a caucus to consider options. You know, if one party is conducting his or her presentation in a way that is, from a mediator's perspective, problematic because they're using language or revisiting things that is clearly just generating hostility on the other side, you can call for a caucus and quite literally help a party, coach a party in terms of how to more constructively and effectively present their viewpoint to the other side. But the dominant reasons why, at least in my experience, a mediator calls for a caucus, if one did it in terms of what's the purpose of a caucus, there are two dominant purposes from my experience, and one is used for the most dominant purpose is you want to explore possible settlement options, that you've engaged the parties in a conversations. Ideas have been proposed and considered by the parties for one reason or another. They are, you know, the responses have been negative. People have shared arguments. They've repeated the same arguments about why something's not acceptable. And the mediator's sense is if there's more from a party's desire for a particular outcome that is prompting their current proposal or position on a proposal, it hasn't come out yet. Maybe meeting separately would do it. So that the purpose of those caucuses is to, quite explicitly in the mediator's mind, to identify issues you want to talk about to explore settlement options. So if it relates to an employment situation, job reinstatement, health insurance coverage, retirement program, back pay, you know, those are issues around the employment status that apparently haven't been resolved. And your goal in the caucus is to explore ways, if there are any, that those particular negotiating topics might be resolved. And one meets in a caucus for purposes of discussing that. And then, of course, just from a practitioner perspective, you know, the question becomes, when you call for a caucus to explore settlement options, you know, is it about one issue? Is it about multiple issues? You need a feel. It's going to vary in terms of the kind of case it is. But exploring settlement options is the most dominant purpose of the caucus. The other purpose of a caucus that I referenced a little earlier is sometimes late in the, usually later in the mediation, one party has adopted a posture with regard to a particular issue or set of issues. And it's what they articulated at 9:30 in the morning and what they're maintaining at 4:30 in the afternoon. I mean, not an iota of movement. I mean, an easy example is a landlord-tenant. Somebody's asking for $30,000 in rent arrears. That's what they asked for at 9:30. And not a dime less than $30,000 is their position at 4:30 in the afternoon. And the commercial tenant has offered various kinds of other numbers, some that have integrity to it. I mean, they're large enough so it's not just to be blown away, but the landlord has not moved at all. And the goal of the caucus is to explore with that person, and I would label it quite non-neutrally, the recalcitrant party. I wouldn't say that out loud as a name, but the one who simply hasn't moved. You call for a caucus to meet with that person first individually, to explore whether or not what their options are if it doesn't resolve here. Given those options, do they want to remain at their $30,000 demand? And if their answer is yes, $30,000, then we bring the conversation to a close. But oftentimes, meeting in caucus at that point, and to meet first with the party that has simply been unchangeable on at least some issues throughout the day, is a good reason to caucus.
How about in situations where, as a mediator, you have some kind of red flags going up, maybe in a divorce or a child support mediation, where you're a little concerned that one party is really being stepped on and there might be something behind it? Is that a time when you might pull in a caucus?
Great question. I should have thought, thanks for asking that. Crucial time. If one thinks, you know, in the jargon terms may be, you know, power imbalance or, you know, but if people are hurt, they're fearful in multiple ways, intimidated by the other side, calling for a caucus just to give people time to regroup and regain themselves is valuable. And then to explore with that individual, you know, comfortable ways for proceeding. Great question.
Okay, so you've convinced me as a mediator. I want to start using caucuses in my next mediation. So what are the general principles of caucus that I need to know?
Okay, well, when you say I've convinced you, that
I'm
means
when a mediator
calls for a caucus, it's got to have a purpose.
Okay.
Many mediators, beginning mediators, working, you know, we all learn. But those who've had no mediation experience, when I'm working with, you know, students or other beginning mediators in a case, the instinct is when one doesn't know what the hell else to do, you call for a caucus. Not a good reason to caucus. Needs to have a purpose.
My gosh. Give us an out.
General principles of caucusing. I think of this, there being three principles of caucusing. The first is, each time one calls for a caucus, one needs to meet with each of the parties at that caucus before reconvening in a joint session, if that's the rhythm. So the second principle is quickly tied to the first. The amount of time one spends in each of those caucuses with the parties does not need to be identical. When I first started in this field, I had wonderful mentors who told me war stories that didn't seem credible then, and I don't believe them now, but they were fun stories. But, you know, if you're mediating a union management, you know, teacher dispute, and you meet with a school board in a caucus, and the caucus ends at 11:30 in the evening, and the news media is covering it, and you're meeting in the some hotel room, and you leave the caucus with the school district officials and say, you know, I'll meet with the teachers, I'll be back to you when I'm done. If you've met with with the school district for 2 hours, and you start the caucus at, you know, 11:30 midnight with the teachers, then that, you know, a lot of people think, quote, you got a caucus for 2 hours with the teachers. Well, I'd have friends who, mentors who would tell me, you know, they met for 15 minutes with the teachers, they got what they needed, and then the mediator went back to his or her hotel room, slept for an hour and a half, just to have, quote, the amount of time the same. That's a funny story, but it need not be the same. The amount of time one spends in a caucus is driven by the purpose of the caucus. So meet with each party every time. The amount of time need not be the same. And then the final, quote, principle is for the person who is the mediator who is caucusing and conducting the caucus and the parties in the room, they're working hard. Their mind is focused and time passes rapidly. For the person who is waiting to meet with the party, time marches very slowly. And so what might be 10 minutes feels like 45 minutes. So to the extent that a mediator might be able to give the party who's not, with whom you're not mediating, something to do, at least for the first 20 seconds that they're alone. You know, could, you know, I'm going to be meeting with Plaintiff Stolberg, Defendant Jones, you heard the last proposal regarding his proposal regarding reinstatement to his position. Perhaps if you could consider, you know, that proposal or, you know, additional explanations as to why that might not work for you, and I'd appreciate it. And at least you give them something to do. Those are what I think of as the principles governing every caucus that one executes.
Yeah, I like that tip about giving them a little assignment so they can feel productive and get their mind off of what are they talking about in there.
That's exactly right.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. All right, well, let's talk mechanics for a second. How do you execute a caucus in practice? What's the practical step-by-step about how that looks in a session?
Excellent. It's part of the mediator's skill, and we have to put ourselves in the middle of the situation. The mediator will be the first one to know she wants to declare a caucus. And so the challenge becomes, in terms of mediator technique, how do you communicate that to the participants that you're going to be moving into a different meeting format? And I'm assuming now that the parties have met in what is referred to generally as a joint session. Everybody's in the same room, the mediator's delivered the opening statement and has asked for at least opening proposals and presentations that would include proposals from each of the parties and some discussion of those proposals. And so after a certain amount of time has elapsed, the mediator has made the judgment remaining together doesn't seem to be advancing the conversations towards greater understanding and or possible resolution. Maybe I can promote those goals more effectively by meeting alone. So in your mind, as the mediator, you're going to suggest moving to caucus. So if one had to label it, there's the mediator is going to announce the caucus, declare a caucus. But like any good storyteller or writer, the mediator needs an effective transition statement when one declares the caucus. So if I'm in my seat as the mediator, I'm looking at presumed plaintiff and defendant, each represented by counsel, you know, at a table or on Zoom. And I say the following, you know what? I want to meet with the plaintiff and their counsel now for, you know, 15, 20 minutes. Would you please leave? Not good. not smooth. One needs that transition statement. So mediators use different kinds of transition statements that can range from, I appreciate the hard work all of you have been doing. From my own experience, sometimes I find it helpful to meet on an individual basis with each of the participants to explore in more depth some of the matters we've been talking about here, or to talk about these things. And I'd like to move to that format now if it's comfortable for everybody. It's a little bit of a transition statement. Or many people, both their oral opening statements and the forms many people use in terms of a consent to mediation, will make reference to procedurally there may come a time, you know, the use of the caucus would be, is a possibility. And so one might say, you know, I think we've reached, as I indicated to you in my opening remarks, sometimes I find it helpful for all of us to meet in private sessions to explore these matters in more detail. I think now is such a time. So you need some kind of a transition statement at a skill level, just so that it's comfortable for everybody and doesn't raise unwarranted fears. The caucus, despite the great, you know, now mediating is more experienced by a broad base of people, but for many people, particularly on the plaintiff side, it's their first experience with mediation. The most surprising move a mediator will make in a mediation, because it doesn't comport with the television vision of what goes on in a courtroom is for a mediator to call for a separate session. So it raises questions about how come you're meeting with them first, not me? Don't you believe me? How come I can't meet with you? And a smooth transition statement will help indirectly address those concerns. Just picking up on that, I think there are two other things a mediator needs to know in making that transition, setting appropriate expectations. A mediator wants to predict to the parties about how long the mediation will take, the caucus will take. And the length of time, frankly, depends completely on the type of case that you're involved in. And fact patterns differ, types of cases differ. And at this point, it's just your informed guess about how long it would be. But if I'm mediating a case involving unrepresented parties referred by a small claims court, a typical caucus might be 10 to 20 minutes. If I'm mediating an employment discrimination suit, a caucus might be 2 hours. So if you call for a caucus at 10, you say, you know, to the defendant, you know, I'm going to be meeting now for the plaintiff, you know, it could very well be 2 hours. You know, feel free to do work and I'm planning to meet with you about 1 o'clock or so. Or I've seen construction cases where quite literally a half a day is devoted to the general contractor and the subs, another half day. So the length of time varies. But what's important is for the mediator to signal what the potential length is. So to go back to that earlier point, if you're waiting for the mediator, you're not puzzled as to how long it's going to take.
And from a mediator's
perspective, it's a guess. And if it turns out you need more time, then a mediator does what a good host does. You stop the conversation. You physically contact the other side if they're waiting for you, if you literally didn't tell them to go have lunch and reconvene. And you say, you know, thank you very much for waiting. The conversation is taking longer than I predicted. I think it will be done in another X number of minutes. And you make a prediction. But I've seen it happen where somebody didn't do that. And what they thought was going to be a 15 to 20 minute caucus turned into an hour and 15 minute caucus. And when the mediator went out to get the other party had left. Mm. So you need to do that. And then depending on the physical arrangements where you're at, some mediators have offices so that there's a conference room that's reserved for one party and another conference room for another, and then even a third conference room where they'd all meet together. If one's operating in, you know, from my experience in a typical court setting, there's one conference room and a hallway. The mediator, in my judgment, owns the conference room. So if you're calling for a caucus, you would remain in the room with a party with whom you are caucusing and excuse the other party or parties to the reception area and ask them to wait out there.
And then you kick the other guy out and then you start the caucus. any procedure once you get in the room with the one party?
Yeah, great. And the first are a series of things that you don't talk about, you just have to do it. From a mediator's perspective, the first thing you have to do is to organize one's notes so that you, the mediator, know what you learned in caucus and what you learned when everybody was together, so that you know what you know and when you learned it and who else might know it. And the easiest practice-wise, if you take a pad of paper, is literally flip to a new sheet of paper, write caucus 1, 2:25 p.m., you know, and the name of the plaintiff's name. And when you finish that, you flip to a new sheet to conduct the caucus with the other party. I've seen some people, you know, they've got their own note-taking systems, and they can write on one sheet of paper and presumably, you know, they know where everything is. My experience, I'm a little skeptical. I think people read mediators' notes upside, you know, They have ways of reading it. And if everything is on one sheet of paper and you bring people back together for any reason and your notepad is on the table, people will read your notes. So one needs to organize one notes. The second thing a mediator does when organizing notes is note the time one begins. Because as I said before, you're working, time will get away from you, and it's important for the mediator to monitor that time. So those things are automatics, non-verbals. Mm-hmm. The verbal things that one says is to indicate to the parties the purpose of the caucus. I wanted to take this opportunity to speak with you regarding the matters. And if it's multiple issues, you know, there are a number of matters related to your termination from service. And we've been talking about, lost pay, health insurance coverage, reinstatement to a job. I want to talk about those things with you. And you basically identify the agenda. And then critically, and to go back again to why I think the caucus is effective, the presumptive practice of mediators is a caucus is confidential. And one wants to make people comfortable. So the mediator would say something like, Ms. Jones, I want to assure you that the matters you share with me in this conversation, you and your counsel, will not leave this room unless you give me permission to share it with the other side if I thought it would be helpful in advancing conversations and resolution. And so you begin with the purpose of the caucus and then the assurance of it's going to be a confidential proceeding.
Okay. And then when you're in the caucus, do you have any some hints for us about techniques you can use to make the caucus effective?
Well, the having just finished saying it's confidential, I want to assure you that. You know, then it's what the mediator does is what she does in conducting a mediation when everybody's there. What are the topics of conversation? What are the issues? And from a mediator's perspective, a crucial strategic choice is in what order am I going to discuss these issues? And how much progress or lack thereof is made before I move to the next. What's the game plan just sequentially? And so one begins the conversation. So Ms. Jones, let's talk about the amount of back pay. How did you calculate? You say you're owed $37,500. How was that calculated? I wasn't quite sure in your initial presentation how that was calculated. So you just begin discussion and exploring what kinds of in that case, numbers or what kinds of options might be possible or invite people to think about options. And one would do something comparable in subsequent caucuses. What a mediator technique-wise finds herself doing systematically in a caucus is what I've described as, it's everybody gets to play law professor in terms of asking hypotheticals. What if the defendant were willing to compensate you at $25,000 for lost wages rather than $37,000 you're asking for now? Is that a workable idea? And the response is, the employer's too stingy. They never offer that much. Well, if they did, what would your response be? And the notion is building on people get to use a caucus to play with possible ideas without having made commitments. A mediator can prompt problem solving by trying to think of possibilities, hypotheticals for people to consider. Mediator uses that a lot. The other thing a mediator technique-wise in a caucus needs to pay attention to. And it happens after the first caucus and then every subsequent caucus. But a typical question that if I've, presume a employment discrimination case, I've met first with the plaintiff and her counsel, and now I'm meeting with the company and the company's counsel. The first question often is, so what'd they tell you in your first caucus? I mean, they want to know, and part of it's a game, but there's a clear sense that you've learned something now share it with me. And what the mediator needs to be clear about in the mediator's own mind is that if the result of, I'm going to label it the first caucus, but it could be any caucus, if the result of the caucus is that in point of fact, the party has shared some flexibility with you on some issues that had not been shared previously, the mediator is not a telephone wire. It's just where you walk and say, oh, here's what she's willing to do now. How about, is that acceptable to you? You're going to blow it as a mediator in terms of losing a possible settlement option if we handle it that way. So the guidance is take whatever flexibility you might have learned, stuff it in your pocketbook or your back pocket, and conduct the next caucus not ignorant of what you've learned in the first caucus, but fresh in terms of addressing the issues and concerns of interest of that party, and then see whether or not from that conversation, there seems to have been flexibility shown in such a way so that if it made sense to say, I think based on conversations I had with the plaintiff that if you, Mr. Defendant, were in the financial neighborhood with respect to lost wages in the $25,000 to $30,000 range, I think that might work. Yeah. You haven't said she's the plaintiff. This is what the plaintiff's agreed to, but you've communicated a number that, in your judgment, may be close enough to where they're at to keep the conversations going. So the two techniques used a lot in the caucus are the use of the hypothetical and then protecting that offer of movement to share it when it's most likely to be advantageous for everybody.
All right. And then how do you close it and move on?
That's important. One starts an individual caucus by identifying the purpose and then assuring people that whatever said remains confidential. The mediator has to close each and every caucus by gaining affirmation of what he or she is permitted by the parties to share with the other side. And mediators use two different approaches, just technique-wise. Some will say, thank you very much, Ms. Jones, for spending time here and Counsel Smith, I appreciate it. I think it's been very constructive. And then the mediator would say, to try to get affirmation, would say, could you tell me, in terms of the things you've shared with me, what you'd feel comfortable with me sharing with the other side if it would be helpful and what you want me to keep confidential? The plus side of doing it that way is that it gives the party and his or her counsel complete control over what's going on. Frankly, my experience is, particularly if it's a reasonably long caucus, is people don't remember everything. Mm-hmm. And I use a different phrasing, and some people charge me with being manipulative, but I put it the following way. I say, thank you very much. Is there anything that we have talked about here that you would not permit me to share if I thought it would be helpful? And from my vantage point, that language puts the responsibility on the party. But
remember,
the goal is not to fool people.
Right,
If they've said something and they haven't previously flagged it, but if they've said something they don't want shared,
they'll tell you.
Will remember it.
Yeah, saying, they'll remember that.
Stalberg,
don't tell me about that. Yep.
But to me, that's a little more comfortable. But I want to say the following. Sometimes in the heat of working, a mediator forgets to close with confirming this. And it's only when you're in the next room meeting with the other party that you suddenly realize, I don't have permission to share any of this stuff.
Yeah.
I think if there's anything that's malpractice among a mediator, it's for the mediator not to go back and confirm it.
Mm-hmm,
conduct it, assume that you've had the information, or skirt around it. The easiest thing to do is simply say, oh, you know, excuse me a moment. There was something I meant to ask the plaintiff and her counsel before. I'll be right back. And you go out, find them, and just confirm it. But if I were directing a program, as I did a number of years ago, that used volunteer mediators, if I ever learned that a volunteer mediator did not get it, and then the way we'd find out about it, of course, is that he or she would use confidential information, that'd be the last time they mediate for that roster.
Right.
It's just, you lose all credibility.
Absolutely. All right. And then is there a final step?
In terms of, you know, if matters have worked out via the caucus, that parties have reached terms of agreement that they would find mutually acceptable, the challenge is, as the mediator, you're the first one that knows that. And so the challenge becomes, how do you communicate to the parties what they've, you know, the terms of resolution? Well, there are two ways to do it. You can bring everybody back together and sort of can say in an opening, you know, thank you very much for your hard work. Based on the conversations, it's my understanding that based on what each of you are willing to do for one another, we've reached a resolution of all matters. And then you turn to the Madam Plaintiff and Counsel, why don't you share with the defendant what you're willing to do to resolve this matter? And you hope that the plaintiff's counsel and plaintiff don't preface their remarks by saying, we still think what you did was in violation of every law, that you're the worst employer ever. We're going to continue to badmouth you. But in the interest of moving forward, you've lost it. But the upside is, if they remember it and they hear one party saying to, you know, their adversary at that point, or what it started out as an opponent, concrete things that they find acceptable, there's a valued bonding process. And think of it in a family context. Yeah. Okay, Jane, I've agreed that with regard to child care responsibilities, I'd be willing to do the following for you. And you, the mediator, know Jane has accepted that. There's something powerful about it coming from the party and or his or her counsel's voice. But my backup, frankly, as a mediator, is there's extreme value in nailing the agreement down. So if I think the first method won't work, I will simply bring people back together. And as the mediator say, I'd like to review for you what each of you have agreed to do for one another. With respect to the matter of back wages, Madam Defendant, you've agreed to pay $25,000 in back lost pay. Plaintiff, you've agreed to take it. Isn't that right?
Mm-hmm.
And they'd say yes, and then I'd go on. So the virtue of that is it nails it down.
Yeah.
The drawback is parties aren't sharing the narrative with one another.
All right. Well, we're getting to the end of the podcast today, but there's a bit that I like to do at the end of every podcast, and it's called Two for Me and One for You. And there's going to be two questions for you as the presenter, and then one question you will have for the audience as a pop quiz to see if they were paying attention today.
Oh, wow.
So the first question is to you. And it's, what is an interesting and relatively brief mediation related story you can share? Maybe about a time caucus worked.
There's some things I can't, you know, the interesting stories I can't share. Let me just portray one that I know has been discussed publicly. It involved a lawsuit by a company against a large California high tech firm. Built and sold office equipment. And what happened in the use of the caucus is the plaintiff, which had been demanding $10 million, shared with the mediator a settlement arrangement that would basically cost no more than $3 million rather than $10 million they had. But they didn't want to make the proposal. So the mediator explored with the other side, sort of made a proposal, got agreement on the framework and the dollar. And a couple hours later, the case settled for $1 million.
Wow, so, that's amazing how much movement.
A lot of movement over a long day. But it, a dazzling display where the caucus was central to advancing ideas, conversations, and movement.
All right, thank you. And question two is, who is an amazing person that you know who's related to the mediation field, and why do you appreciate them?
Well, I've had the good fortune to know a number of amazing people, but particularly for Ohio audience, no one is more special and has done more for the development, implementation, and professional competency and quality in terms of mediation use than my colleague, Nancy Rogers, who was dean of the law school, professor at Moritz Law School, dean of the Moritz Law School, and served a short time as attorney general for the state of Ohio as well. If one needs a model of dignity and integrity, she's perfect.
That's so sweet. We're so lucky to have her in Ohio, for sure. Yes, for sure. All right. And the last question is for you to give the audience a knowledge check. Professor, what is a pop quiz question they should be able to answer after listening to this podcast?
Why would it be a mistake for a mediator, once he or she learns of movement from a party in a caucus, to immediately share that with the other party with whom you're caucusing? So that you'd go in, you'd leave the first caucus and say, the plaintiff's willing to reduce her demand from $100,000 to $65,000, is that acceptable to you? Presuming you have permission to share.
All right, good question. I'm sure our listeners will think about it. And do you have any closing words before we wrap up today?
It's been an honor to work with you. You're terrific. Kate, thanks so much for guiding this and for the honor of inviting my participation in this important
service. Oh, well, it was my pleasure. All right, well, that's a wrap for today. Huge thank you to Professor Emeritus Josh Stolberg for sharing his wealth of mediation knowledge with us today. And thank you to everyone out there listening, especially those of you working for justice. I hope you will join us for the next episode of Civility and Solutions. Until then, stay healthy.